TR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Good morning, Vancouver. I am Farha Khan. Welcome to a special edition of Prof Talk with Robert Silverman. I am sitting alongside pianist and professor emeritus Robert Silverman, one of Canada's distinguished pianists, whose career spans more than five decades and who has performed in concert halls throughout the world and in every major orchestra in Canada. We are here at the School of Music and seated in front of a gorgeous Steinway piano in Professor Jane Coop's studio. Robert Silverman, it is a real pleasure to have you on the show today. Can you tell us what piece of music you just played for us?
This was one of the pieces from Mussorgsky's great collection called Pictures at an Exhibition. And this one is entitled Bidlo, or Cattle, but there's some question as to what it's really about. I don't believe it was about cattle at all. It's a long story, but basically, Mussorgsky had a close friend named Victor Hartmann, who was an architect and an artist who died suddenly, and some friends of Hartmann's organized a big exhibition, and of his works posthumously, and Mussorgsky went to it and was very taken with this exhibition and created a number of piano pieces that reflected some of the paintings, except there never was a painting. We have the catalog of this exhibition. Not much of Hartman's work exists, but there is no such painting that ever was called Cattle. And this is not what Mussorgsky, I think, was really talking about. It's a just conjecture. He wrote a letter to a friend, says, between us we'll call it Cattle. Some people have said, well, no, it's not really cattle, it's an ox cart. But that doesn't really make sense. Why wouldn't he have called it an ox cart if it was? There was a painting of Hartman that this was during a period where Russia had hegemony over Poland, and they weren't treating the Poles very well, and there was a painting of that, or a picture of that. And I believe that Mussorgsky just called it Cattle to show what people were being treated like. Right. in a city in Poland, Sandomir, which is where this painting comes from. So it may be, on the other hand, there may be some Mussorgsky scholars who think, I don't know what I'm talking about, and I won't argue with them, but I don't think it's about cattle.
That's a great story. Now, I would like to ask you, when did you first begin to play the piano, and who influenced you most in your piano studies?
One of these days, I'll actually start playing the piano the way I like to. But in the meantime, I know I was at the keyboard as a very young boy. I was 4 years old. But my parents saw that their young little kid was going to a radio station and always putting on classical music. And so they went to a teacher, a friend of theirs who lived next door, and they said, you know, I think Robert, Bobby then, would like to, I think, why don't we try him studying piano? Oh, come on, it's much too early. He can start at 8. Well, yeah, or 9. Yeah, but why don't we just start him? So he did, and I guess one of the things teachers did then, they probably still do, or they should, is they train the ear, so they'll say, this is C. What note's that? F. Fine. And this is C. What note's this? Or something. So about two or three lessons later, the teacher said, okay, so turn your ear. We're going to try your ear test. And she said, this is C. And I said, yeah, you said that last time. And that's when they knew maybe that there was a bit of talent there with this kid. True story.
Oh, wow.
But I never studied, I wasn't trained, I wasn't conditioned to be to take piano seriously, but just as something to enrich me. The more I got into, in fact, I even studied engineering for 3 years at McGill in the 50s, and I also was an average kid. I mean, I was brought up, I actually played organized hockey when I was young. I wasn't any good at it, but we did have to sign, everybody on the team had to sign a contract with the Montreal Canadiens. So I like saying I'm the only Canadian concert pianist with a signed contract with Montreal Canadiens, and there was a period where they could have used me even when I was in my 60s, yeah. But anyway, those are different times. But as I hit my early 20s, I suddenly realized this is not what I wanted to do, this is what I had to do, and I did it. And
where did you study ultimately?
Well, I studied in a lot of places. I was brought up in Montreal, and at that time, for many people, automatically went to McGill, which wasn't that bad a place to go automatically. And so I studied there. I was studying engineering there, too. I got a Bachelor of Arts from Concordia, then it was called Sir George Williams University. But I went back to McGill, finished up a degree. I studied in Vienna for 2 years, where I heard some really amazing concerts. But post-war Vienna was not a very pleasant place to be in many ways, but I did hear some great music. Came back to Montreal for a year and then studied at the Eastman School of Music in Rochester. Mm-hmm. And got some degrees, was offered some teaching situations, entered a few competitions and did pretty well in them and in some of them. And then I came here as a faculty member, not knowing how long mm-hmm. it would be. It was in my mid-30s by now, 1973, and I've stayed ever since.
You've never left. Now, your career at UBC spans over 30 years. What inspired you to come back and return to teach?
I love the act of teaching, the process of it. I like meeting young people, seeing them learn, trying to help, pass on what I've known. Their standards are, it's a very, very different world now. Kids nowadays, there are so many kids who play so wonderfully now, but on the other hand, sometimes they're a little separated from the culture in which the music that emanates, that the music that they study comes from. And when it's not that long ago, I mean, but as I was just joking, I said, I turned 70 this year. One of these days my voice will actually complete its changing process, but in the meantime, I am 70. And I said, just start me off, take two of my lifetimes, and we're back with Beethoven. I mean, and I met people I met one man, an old man when I was young, whose grandmother had met Beethoven. And that doesn't make me a great pianist, but on the other hand, the culture was within living memory of my teachers. Mm-hmm. And now it's one or two generations beyond that, and there are certain things I think that we got that perhaps not everybody has. But on the other hand, one of my students, you mentioned I was in Jane Coop's studio. That's what brings me here this year. She's on sabbatical, and she asked me to teach some of the most gifted of her kids, and I was very happy to do it. And one of them actually won a competition just the other couple of weeks ago, this Kniggy competition, named after a family named Kniggy, who been very generous to the School of Music. And they started a national competition with a sizable first prize. And my student won it. So, it's wonderful. I love teaching. I love also not having to do it. And I really love not having to attend any meetings and be on any committees. That I really love. But it's a win-win situation. But I come in here. Yeah, every time I leave, I feel more rejuvenated than I did when I came in here, because I have very good and challenging and interesting kids to work with.
Now, you've written that you try to bring notes on a page to life as vividly as possible, while neither adding anything that is not there nor subtracting anything that is there. What do you mean by that?
I mean exactly what I said. I mean, of course, you know, different people play piano differently. In fact, no two people can possibly play the same way, because we reflect we bring our own psyche, we bring our own experiences to it, we bring our own aesthetic sense to it. Some people, when they play the piano, I'm taking extreme positions. Mm-hmm. Some people who play the piano use any piece that they're playing to basically inject themselves into the music they're playing, where what you're hearing is them. This is what I'm expressing myself through the music of so-and-so. I don't think anyone would own up to doing that, but some people do. Some famous ones, for instance, Canada's icon Glenn Gould. You didn't... There were some of the things he did were absolutely... They're indelibly etched in the history of performance. They were so wonderful. Other ones are so indelibly etched for different reason, because he was always being Glenn Gould. Mm-hmm. And he said, what's the point of playing the way everybody else does? If you want to hear everybody else, do it that way. I mean, he was joking, but I don't think he was. And there's some lesser pianists who also just... They bring a certain aesthetic of very beautiful sound, even if the music doesn't call for it. And we can get back in a minute, if you want, to the piece that I just played, Mussorgsky. But and then there's others who will do nothing, or very little, it seems, other than just play what's on the page as accurately as possible. And, but there are many others, or I would say the vast majority of people, try to find a balance between that. But I've seen it written about me. I've heard people say that you basically, the thing that they like about my pianist, the way I play, is that I try to make myself disappear and let the feelings of the composer, or not the feelings, all the ideas of the composer come out. And paying very, very close attention to the printed text, not changing things or not doing exaggerated tempo fluctuations, whether they're called for or not. And, I mean, I'm by no means the only person alive doing this. In fact, most of the pianists that I admire all do it, and always have. And there are some times that I hear pianists of the other camp, like another one was Vladimir Horowitz, the late Vladimir Horowitz, who did a couple of recordings of the pictures in exhibition. Basically, he changed the whole piece. He made it was much more Horowitz. But Horowitz was a great musical phenomenon, so you're listening to Horowitz. That's fine. Nothing wrong with that. But then if you follow the score, where did this come from? Where did that come from? Why did he add this note? Why is he... Mussorgsky says, play it softly. He doesn't know how the music goes. Horowitz bangs it out. What's the point? And I mentioned Mussorgsky came around... this in the highest sense, he was a musical amateur. He wasn't a professionally trained musician. He certainly knew how to write, and he was certainly a profoundly deep musician. But he was also profoundly original, and this sort of very romantic, perfumey way of playing, let's say, a way I might play a Chopin nocturne, which I've recorded many on one of my recordings, it would be so appropriate. This music is very expressive, the range of pictures that Mussorgsky takes us to see and actually injects himself into in many of the ways. But it's the one thing it's not. It's very expressive, but it's almost anti-romantic. And in your face the other way. And again, that's what I mean by trying to bring out what the composer, everything that I see that the composer... Luther has tried to do. However, when all is said and done, someone can say, but that's still what you think it is. And of course, it is. It can't be any other way. And you can say, well, it's too bad Mussorgsky didn't make a recording. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, providing Mussorgsky the pianist was as good as Mussorgsky the composer. And there's some other early in the 20th century, there were a lot of composers who actually made recordings. And some of them, like Rachmaninoff, are sensational, but others, like Ravel, are basically are an offense to the music that they composed. And by no means, aside from maybe getting the idea of a tempo and maybe an approach to just how, romantic or over-expressive the music should be, there isn't too much one can really glean that is useful. On the other hand, someone like Mahler was a great, he didn't perform, but he was a great pianist, and any conductor who wants to hear how Mahler's symphony should go should search out Mahler's piano rolls of his own symphonies, because he really did know what he wanted. Mm-hmm. So that's a very long answer to a very short question, more than you ever thought you'd get.
Now, when you played the piece at the start, you weren't actually looking at any notes. It was obviously in your head. When do the notes or a piece that you feel you've mastered in some way actually become part of your mm-hmm. your brain and your memory?
Well, it generally does. The ability to memorize music is, it's a gift. It's just like a lot of other things, like perfect, just when I was talking about my perfect pitch where I said, yeah, that's thing. It's the same thing. Those are very useful things. They aren't what really makes you a sensational musician. Two of my favorite pianists, and I better not mention their name, but I mean, just in the whole world, and they both have memories that are not flawless, and they both will make, I've never attended a concert by any of them where they haven't stumbled over a memory blank, had to just go back, and they know where it is. And I mean, it's a live performance. It's not you wouldn't want that to appear in a recording, but for a live performance, what's wrong with it? But I have a pretty decent memory. It's not now as good as it was. So when the pictures, it's interesting. This is really, I'm preparing them for a concert as we talk. I'm preparing it for a concert.
On the island, right? In Nanaimo.
In Nanaimo. And it's the first time I'm going to actually play the pictures in an exhibition complete. On the other hand, I've known and loved these pieces ever since I was a teenager, and I used to slog my way through the pieces a lot when I was in my teens and early 20s. So I know the notes, it's instilled in my consciousness. On the other hand, more recently when I took on this task of learning and performing and recording all the Mozart sonatas, even though it's Mozart, it's not like there's a blank page up there, but my memory just wasn't as trustworthy. And in some of the pieces, particularly the ones that I learned just for this project, I definitely kept the music in front of me. But there's violinists who never think of appearing on stage without the music in front of them. And string quartets, music's always in front of them. And so it's,
I was always curious, when it's not in front of you, does the music become instinctive in some way? Because you're not reading notes.
I'm living the notes, yeah. I mean, it just how, this is one of the things about teaching, but also I've learned how to teach myself too. You're not just the notes are not just haphazardly written. In fact, with a lot of lesser composers, Time has filtered out the ones from previous eras. We only get to hear the greater ones. But every time I have been asked to play a piece by, let's say, Mozart's contemporary or a Beethoven contemporary or a Brahms contemporary, I always have trouble memorizing it, because there isn't that inner logic that the music of the great composers invariably has. Notes are what they are. They have to be that way. Mm-hmm. And the greatest composers understand the implications of their work. And, you know, like in art, for instance, you take a master like Jackson Pollock, and it has a rhythm to them. His works, I think, have a rhythm to them that is absolutely compelling. On the other hand, you could say, well, but if you just took a paintbrush or whatever and just start splattering dots on, they may have a lot in common. But for all that, it doesn't have what Pollock has, because Pollock was... He was just basically dancing on. He was using his arms to dance the splatters onto the canvas, and it's different.
I'd like to ask you, what does Mozart mean to you when you think of Mozart, and what do you tell your students when you're teaching Mozart?
I usually tell them. You know, Mozart, I didn't make this up, I wish I had. Mozart's too easy for students and too hard for professionals. I'm reminded of, or someone said, who's your favorite composer? So he said, well, I love Beethoven, Haydn. Crazy about Mahler. What about Mozart? Oh, I thought you meant everybody else. It's sheer perfection. The closest thing to perfection that ever walked this planet and composed music. Well, Bach, right. Up there. Just almost never taking a false step, just knowing instinctively what to do. And the music is always engaging, always interesting. And it's just Haydn. I remember once writing Mozart's father and saying, before God, I tell you, this is the greatest composer I have ever, I know, living or dead. He has taste. He has the most unbelievable technique. He has absolutely everything. And it's all done. He also does it in such a simple manner. It's not. He gets away with some of the most unbelievable. Thing. He paints himself into a corner many times and musically, and then finds a way out of it that no one else could think of. As an opera composer, no one understood the character of women the way Mozart did. Just his sense of drama, he had everything. Truly wondrous, and it was like a sponge. When he was young, he didn't know too much Bach, but a friend of his, in the middle of his all too short career, towards the end of it, his friend of him said, "I have a huge Bach collection. You should look at some of this stuff." Bach, Mozart borrowed a few scores, and then almost immediately he started including much more of the kind of things that Bach would do: imitation, counterpoint, just the study of. Imitate one voice imitating another, you know, like a round, Frère Jacques. But that's a simpler form. But I mean, the idea of voices imitating and talking each other, imitating each other, and And this imitative counterpoint began working its way into Mozart, and you see it at the very, when it's first starting, it's just a little awkward. These are not maybe some of his greatest, but then within a few pieces, all of a sudden he's incorporated it into his being, and then there's always, and it's again effortlessly, and he's incorporated what he could take from Bach and made it his own. Mm-hmm. And I've played all 18 sonatas. Mm-hmm. And the sonatas are not supposed to be considered Mozart's really finest in the way, let's say, that Beethoven's sonata represent some of the best writing he ever did. Supposedly that's not really true with Mozart. But I love his sonatas, and I find them so engaging. Mm-hmm. And as you may have heard, not too easy.
Thank you.
This is Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM. I am Farha Khan. If you've just tuned in now, you just heard Robert Silverman playing a recording of Mozart from his forthcoming CD of all the sonatas. The full title is Sonnet No. 12 in F Major, and today is the first day it has been released on radio. I had the privilege to speak with Robert Silverman 2 weeks ago at the School of Music, alongside a beautiful Steinway piano in Professor Jane Koop's studio. It was truly a wonderful and humbling experience. Robert Silverman is recognized as one of Canada's premier pianists, whose career spans more than 5 decades. He's not only recognized as an extraordinary pianist, but he has a wonderful, polished technique. If you would like to hear more of Robert Silverman, you can visit his website at robertsilverman.ca. I'd like to conclude today's show with playing another recording of his, a beautiful piece, I should say, by Chopin.
Thank you.
You are tuned in this morning to Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM. We've just been speaking with Professor Emeritus Robert Silverman. Today, the UBC Chinese Ensemble, Music of the Cultural Revolution, directed by Alan Thrasher with guest soloists Huang Jirong and Pan Jiaoming, will be performing at 12 noon today in the Recital Hall at the School of Music building. And also today, doctoral student Todd Jones from the Department of Zoology, he was a guest on Prof Talk last November. He will be giving a lecture titled Conservation and Biology of Leatherback Sea Turtles and Ocean Revolution. That talk will be held between 4:30 and 5:30 p.m. in the Aquatic Ecosystems Research Laboratory in room 120. And finally, this evening, as part of the Environmental Speaker Series, Dr. Kai Chan, assistant professor from the Institute for Resources, Environment, and Sustainability, will be speaking about getting past the doom and gloom, advancing the green agenda. That lecture will take place tonight at 8 p.m. in St. John's College in the Fairmont Social Lounge. Now, we would love to hear your feedback, so please do drop us a line at proftalk@gmail.com. And for an updated schedule of April shows, you can visit our blog at ubcproftalk.blogspot.com. And you can hear the podcast of this show anytime on citr.ca. Stay tuned now for Breakfast with the Browns with your host, Peter. I am Farha Khan. Thank you for tuning in this morning.
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.